I will work day in and day out. Wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Clark, a fellow at the Joseph Rand Foundation, a visiting fellow at Nuffield College, Oxford, a contributing editor at Prospect, and the editor of Broke, Fixing Britain's Poverty Crisis. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Great to be here. Thanks, Will.
It's great to have you on, Tom. And the first question that I'd like to ask is, what prompted you to put this book together? And what was the process behind choosing the writers who would feature in this collection?
It's a good question. I mean, what we loosely call the poverty industry, I think often, and I'm guilty of this very much myself sometimes, you know, we get very excited when the household below average incomes data comes out and we see people moving up or down relative to the 60% of median income after housing cost poverty line. And quite quickly, you're in a world where, Stalin, to quote an unsavory person, is supposed to have said, whereas, you know, the death of one person might be a tragedy, the death of a million people, well, that's a statistic. Once on arriving at Roundtree, kind of out of being the full-time editor at Prospect up till the autumn of 2021, I was thinking with my colleague Graham Cook about how we could get Roundtree to kind of try and bring poverty to life with a bit more of this kind of direct reportage. And the moment, it was almost exactly a year ago when it really hit me that how necessary this task was, you know, we kept seeing these awful statistics come out. Malnutrition in hospitals, people who were in hospital, maybe something else, twice as many of them are suffering from malnutrition as a decade ago, and rough sleeping, we just saw the other day, it's up by a quarter in a single year, et cetera, et cetera. But none of these numbers, particularly when you have Boris Johnson in number 10, he could just brush them off. And then we had this single elderly woman, Elsie, 77 years old, a widow, ring up Good Morning Britain on the morning that Boris Johnson was on and sort of ask for any advice. Because as she said to the presenter, who then put it to the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson then was, you know, like, she had nothing left, no money left for anything. She couldn't keep warm at home, so she'd go and get on the bus and stay on the bus all day. Boris Johnson was normally so good at, like, you know, overturning a kind of cartload of statistics, suddenly really stumped. He's kind of, well, you know, it only thanks to the freedom pass that I introduced that Elsie's able to stay on the bus all day. And suddenly you sort of felt that complacency wasn't possible where you'd got this personal testimony. So that was the backstory to why we thought reported stories of individual human cases was the right way to go. And then in terms of the people we chose, I think most of the people we chose were people I knew because I'd worked with before, normally at Prospect, sometimes elsewhere, on doing long-form stuff that just took individual people's stories seriously. Now, there were very different types of writers, and I hope that's a strength of the collection. So we've got people who are very lyrical writers, like Cal Flynn, who writes very beautifully in a very kind of literary way. And then we've got really experienced, really kind of gritty reporters like Jennifer Williams, who writes about deaths in the book and with a real emphasis on getting to the facts. And so we kind of given we've got to do this quite quickly, we need to have a team of people. We need people we know can write, and we need people to give it some flavour and some kind of variety. You're going to write in different ways. But above all, people who have shown me in the past that they would go and follow individual stories find out about real people's lives.
Absolutely. And those individual stories are really core to how the book is so powerful. To what extent do you think that the individual stories are able to capture the scale of inequality and poverty and the sense that a lot of the system in Britain is broken in a way that's easier for a reader to understand than a simple presentation of a statistic. You use the famous Starling quote there. Do you think that is really something that is able to hit readers more sometimes, being able to follow particular individuals' stories through the essays rather than just simply seeing the stark statistics?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I mentioned about Boris Johnson, but we could go further back. You know, we could talk about when we think about the Great Depression in the United States, for example, very quickly discussion turns to, you know, the Grapes of Wrath, rather than, and that's a fictional story, but a human story. Era in Britain, people would think of George Orwell or J.B. Priestley's kind of reported stories of individual people rather than the statistics of the unemployment and labour exchanges that would have made the same point in a numbers rather than a stories type way. So when we look at these stories, I mean, you know, this is real reportage. So, like, for example, we have Samira Shackle going to Tottenham Food Bank, and she talks very interestingly about the types of people who come in. You see people coming in that wouldn't have been at a food bank, you know, in the recent past, because, for example, they're wearing a worker's overall. So those little kind of details of observation that you don't see in statistics. But above all, like, she talks about someone called Yvonne, for example, who used to be an extremely energetic woman, brought up her family and had more than one job. Couldn't quite believe that she found herself needing to go to the food bank, and Samira sought her out and talked to her. And she said, you know, the first time I tried to come along to this food hub, I was in the queue, which was a very long queue, and I turned away because I just thought this isn't for me. But a week later, she was so hungry she had to go there. And that's the kind of thing that I think lodges in the mind. And then Samira kind of asks her about, you know, how food used to be a source of pleasure for her. She used to cook these big plates of kind of West Indian food, and now she can't. And Samira also got from her the way that she doesn't tell four adult children that she's going to the food bank and the food hub because she doesn't want to worry them. And again, that's something that you wouldn't see, even if you looked at the numbers on food bank use, the way that poverty kind of ends up cutting people apart from the very people who should be there to support them. So there's a kind of texture, isn't there? And that's just one story. There's other stories I'll talk to, I'm sure, as we go on, but I'm just thinking of that because it's right in the front of the book. And hunger is something we've all experienced. Hunger, you know, hopefully not because of lack of money, but we all know what it is to feel hungry. But what it feels like to feel hungry because you just can't afford to eat. I think listening to Yvonne and her testimony really makes that much more real.
Absolutely, and one of the issues that each of the essays highlights is that it isn't just legislative change that is needed, but there's also cultural change that's needed in the way that we deal with poverty. And an example being that how renters are sometimes perceived and treated by landlords and letting agents and similarly people using food banks, how often sometimes they feel a certain degree of dehumanization by the way food bank statistics are sometimes discussed by some politicians and some media outlets. How do you think that this necessary change in attitudes can be achieved alongside changes to the law?
I mean, it's absolutely right what you say. First of all, you know, stigma and the kind of mental kind of load of living with poverty is just a huge, huge part of it. And people feeling ostracized, feeling cut off. Secondly, like, let's be honest, this is going to be really, really hard to change because, like, these sort of stigma against, you know, beggars or whatever, like, you know, go very, very deep into the culture, you know, right back through the Victorian kind of idea of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor who need to up the workhouse. You know, so these things kind of, the way people talk about, oh, that's an dreadful estate, it's like a kind of sewer. And, you know, you get these awful ways of talking that people would have picked up from their parents, who would have picked it up from their grandparents, who would have picked it up from their own parents, who might remember the workhouse. So these things go very deep. I think they can be changed. You know, we've seen equally deep prejudices against, you know, homosexuality, to take one recent example, which have gone away over a generation. And there's a lot of work to do, obviously, on the media, which is very hard to do. But the one thing that politicians can do is watch what they say themselves, because they have a power to frame the debate. And I cite a study by John Curtis, which he did back in the sort of last days of the New Labour government, where he looks at British social attitudes data from, I think it started that survey in 1983 or 1984, and he saw a great swerve, you know, to what we would call the right, or the kind of individualistic, non-empathetic account of poverty, that took place around 1994, 1995, because that was when, you know, as he wrote all before him, Tony Blair was talking very much about how, you know, although, you know, we needed to do things about child poverty, we also needed to make sure there was no fifth option. There was no people swinging the lead or lying in bed. And Labour basically stopped defending benefits as it had done up until then. And then John Curtis pinpoints this, because he says it's not a general move in public opinion. It was a move amongst Labour supporters, suggesting that, you know, that there was a move that was led from the top of the Labour Party, essentially towards a more kind of sceptical, kind of deserving versus undeserving, or kind of line around that time. Now, of course, Labour went on to do lots of fantastic things on the headline rates of benefits for families with children and for various other groups, particularly pensioners. That kind of deserving and undeserving kind of line remained there right through the period, and indeed into the change of government in 2010, when the mood changed and the money changed and they were suddenly cutting instead. And so then when the time came for cuts, because there was no one really fulsomely defending social security and the idea that no one should fall too far behind, a lot of those cuts were made very easily with programs like Benefits Street and one called on Channel 5, Gypsies on Benefits and Proud, believe it or not, that was a program. This created a very poisonous atmosphere in which benefits could be cut very easily by George Osborne. And, you know, we talk in the stories in the book about there's one couple, maybe we'll come on to talk about them more, that we call Mike and Sandra, who, you know, during that kind of deserving versus undeserving kind of argument of the cuts, actually found themselves hounded, you know, as a couple, where both of them were on benefits because there'd been something about it in the local paper. And it means that they were still talking to our reporters now on condition of anonymity. On a more hopeful note, once Labour started really getting stuck in and opposing benefit cuts pretty staunchly, which was under Jeremy Corbyn, you know, for all his problems, the Corbyn-McDonnell Labour Party stood firm on that. Then they started to see that the coalition beat a retreat on working tax credits, on various cuts to the disability benefit. At the moment, Labour's running a mile from Jeremy Corbyn on most things, but I think it's staying relatively close to him on opposing most of these benefit cuts. As far as I can tell, they're not promising to reverse it, but they're not kind of implying that there needs to be any more tightening, or at least they weren't. I just saw a story this morning as it happens, Will, whether we're talking about if they crack down on fraud, which we know is really quite small, they might be able to pay a cost of living payment to people. So I hope that that's something they're not about to retreat on, but I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt in the book because I haven't seen them retreat on it yet.
In the foreword to the book, Kerry Hudson speaks very movingly about the impact of continual movement that had it had on her family and on her as a child in particular. And given that, as the Joseph Rowntree Foundation stated at the start of this year, there are around 3.9 million children in poverty in the UK, what do you think can be done to ensure that children are not only lifted out of poverty en masse, but there is also, and going back to this cultural point, more effort put in to stop the stigmatisation that many children who are in poverty feel towards you know, the attitudes that some of their fellow classmates have towards them?
Well, I mean, you know, like there are things you can do through the education system and through other parts of civil society like sports club. You know, we have had stamp it out about, you know, racism in football grounds. There could be a zero tolerance approach to poverty bullying in schools, and I think that would be a good thing. If you can do it for racism, why can't you do it also for that? It's interesting, in Kerry Hudson's, as you say, moving forward, she talks about you know, the stigma of getting the tokens that allows you to have the free school meal. You know, I can really understand that, because there might be 5 or 10 kids in the school of class of 30 who are getting their dinner on this different basis, and everyone knows they're the free school meals kids. So, like, stamping down on bullying is something that feels like a no-brainer. But then you get into the kind of policy where it gets a bit more difficult, because in a poverty emergency, what's the priority? Is it to say free school meals for everyone? Maybe that would be a nice way to solve the problem, because then, no one would stand out by getting the free school meals. But it might also be that you think benefits are so low now that the top priority has to be increasing the rate so that people, when they go home, aren't returning to sort of squalor and want. The priority has to be to do that rather than spend the extra money on free school meals for kids who don't need them. And I don't think any more than with, you know, you're not going to find the right balance to strike there when it comes to those kind of spending issues out of reportage much more easily than you're going to find it out of statistics. I think we just need to, like, accept that it's a tricky balance, you know, how far to target help against how far to make it universal, and there's a good case for some of both. But we need to take account of what people say. And so if, for example, you have an arrangement which is making the children feel like Kerry with the, you know, the hiding the token for the free school meal up her sleeve, you know, maybe if you can't afford to do that all at once for everyone and you need to spend money on increasing benefits instead, maybe you could just run the system in a different way so that, like, you know, at the start of the term, a child is registered one way or the other, and the parents who can afford to pay up front for the whole term, and so it's not obvious day to day. So, I mean, like, what I'm saying there, both in the idea of a kind of zero tolerance towards bullying, and also not demeaning people through the way you administer things, is basically what we should definitely do is be thoughtful, and then we should, in the way we run things, and then secondly, we should take the experience, the unpleasant experience of being on the wrong side of one of those welfare systems, and take that into account along with everything else we've got to weigh up in working out how far to do things universally and how far to target help where it's most needed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, the link between deprivation and disease with poverty is explored in Danny Garevoli's essay, particularly highlighting the issues in Glasgow. And it's very stark reading because it shows how the scale of poverty can have an impact on people's physical and mental health, which in turn, of course, has an impact on the health service as well, because people, you know, having those physical and mental health issues as a result of poverty and deprivation can often need to healthcare support from the NHS. Do you think in areas in which poverty is at its very worst, it's a case not only of the government investing money in those areas, but also urgently working on building and repairing the infrastructure, such as hospitals, roads, train services, etc., in those areas, because often the lack of infrastructure hinders any ability to break poverty in those particular areas, and that by investing not only in social services and in other programs, but also investing in infrastructure, you can really break poverty in those areas.
I mean, what my take on this really is that, like, you know, poverty, if you like, is an incredibly complex phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
but it's a at the same time, it's a simple problem. And what I mean by that is that, you know, every type of poverty you can come up with has a habit of morphing into another form of poverty. So, you know, like in Danny Garavelli's chapter, as you mentioned, we've got all these people who have terrible economic problems and no prospects in these bits of Glasgow, and that might lead them to depression, and it might lead them to drink or to drugs. It might just, like, you know, put them in a despondent mood where their immune system goes on holiday, which, and if you get very down. And none of this is news. You know, we know that, like, in the 1980s, when you, like, not by any means across the whole country, but in places like Glasgow itself and Liverpool and other big industrial centres that suddenly became post-industrial centres, people kind of lost their identity. And as a result, they kind of felt terrible, and they sometimes numbed the pain with heroin and all the problems that went with that. So there's certainly lots of interlocking elements to this. You know, in Francis Ryan's chapter, we've got ill health turning into a lack of money, and in Danny Garavelli's, we've got a lack of money turning into ill health. So it's all kind of complicated cycles and all the rest of it. And in Glasgow in particular, Danny's chapter highlights some decisions that were made decades ago, maybe with good intentions, about the way to organise social housing in Glasgow, which, you know, there was a policy at the time which was like, let's create these buzzing new towns around the edge of Glasgow and move all the skilled workers out there, and that would be a great thing. But then it left a kind of a residualization effect and a lack of hope and aspiration effect on the people left in the middle of Glasgow. And so, you know, it did even worse than other post-industrial centres. So yes, things like housing and, you know, the broader economy, and then, you know, the infrastructure you allude to, you know, trains and buses and very practical things that allow people to get out and improve their lot, are clearly really important. But, you know, at the same time, there's just, at the moment, it feels to me like there's just a kind of real emergency that needs emergency relief, you know, with fuel prices and everything else. Because all of these complicated problems that we talk about, you know, they're not necessarily things like addiction aren't going to be completely solved because you give someone a bit more universal credit. But all the problems we come up against, all of them would at least be somewhat soothed. And some of them would disappear if people had a little bit more money in their pockets. So, I mean, I'm at a point where I'm saying, you know, start to think about raising Social Security so that people get the mental bandwidth where they can start to think about using the better trains, using the better buses that might also need to go in there. And what's most chilling of all, as your listeners will have picked up in the last couple of months from various stories that have been on the news, and why it's so urgent to go and visit Glasgow, where life expectancy has been dreadful for ages, is that, you know, we've had a number of years now where life expectancy in England and Scotland, but let's say in England, to separate it from the Glasgow case study, has stalled. We've got poorer communities where first women and then men and women were starting to see their life expectancy go down before the pandemic. And then, of course, it goes down even more during the pandemic. And, you know, there is at least a possibility that we might be looking at an American-type situation where life expectancy on average actually starts to go down, which, you know, is the kind of thing that should only happen in wartime. Like, you know, America, a country where poverty is worse than it is in England, and however bad things would be, they could be worse. You know, shows why you don't really need to care about poverty as such. You need to care about people dying. And if you do, you need to care about the poverty as well.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Frances Ryan's essay there, and in her essay she highlights how the system that we have in place at the moment could be more of a hindrance than a help for those in need. As she says in the essay, benefit bureaucracy can be impenetrable if you're healthy, but when you're ill, it's all the harder. To what extent do you think that those who are in charge of the systems, in charge of the benefit system, are aware of these difficulties that many people face in accessing them? And how much do you think it would help tackling poverty if the systems were made more accessible than they currently are?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, and there always has been, a difference in, you know, the way the benefit system interacts with people and the way the tax system interacts with people. You know, because one is more aimed at better off people who are, you know, giving the government money, and the other one's people claiming money off the government. So the government has a different attitude to it. And at one level, that's understandable. But at another level, as the number of people, you know, working age people now who are in poverty, more likely to be in working households than not working households, they might well be working as, let's say, care workers. The fact that they need a top up to like pay their bills from the government doesn't mean they're putting less into society than a kind of hedge fund manager or something. And I think most people would think quite the reverse. So given that society doesn't necessarily see the kind of people who these days need top ups as undeserving, and it shouldn't see them as undeserving, I think it's time for the people running the benefit system to be pleased, as we will be the tax system, where, you know, it can be frustrating, but by and large, if you stick around on the phone, they'll explain to you what's expected to you, if you're expected to do, if you're honest. Whereas with the benefit system, you know, it is baffling. And we get cases where simply different computers within the Department for Work and Pensions don't talk to each other. People end up building up these huge debts. And then they get told, sorry, you owe £1,800, you know, because let's say your child benefit stopped. You thought that would automatically mean, like Becker in Glasgow thought, that your other benefits would be adjusted in line with, you know, because they've got the accurate record of the child's birth. They cease to be a child. You stop getting your child benefit and you might think you're all sorted, but it turns out you need to tell a different part of the TWP separately about that. And as a result, you build up this debt and they tell you about it after a year, and at least at the first letter, they say, we want you to pay this back, you know, like, tens of pounds every week when you've got no money whatsoever. And so it's a huge cause of stress, you know, really huge cause of stress for people. And sometimes if you ring around and stick around, they'll agree to let you pay it back more gradually. Sometimes they won't. And it's not just about the complexity and the length of the forms and all of those things. It's also about the attitude, you know, like where we saw with the Chancellor in March saying, you know, we're going to impose sanctions a bit more rigorously for some groups. I mean, that means that people in job centres will be hearing, people running job centres, that it's part of their job to dock people's benefits quite sharply for being late for an appointment, And, you know, if you read these stories in this book, you just see that people are juggling all kinds of care and responsibilities and whatnot. And it might be that there's all kinds of good reasons why you're late for an appointment or whatever, or you just forget what's going on that day. And it needs to be run with a certain mercy, with a lot of warning, and with, you know, a fair number of fair chances. I think most people would accept that, and it's not at the moment.
I totally agree. And one of the things that I think a lot of people face, and we've touched upon it earlier in the podcast, is a sense of feeling of discrimination and a feeling that that they're not being helped of because of something related to them personally. And Daniel Trilling's essay, which deals with the broken asylum system and the immigration system, certainly highlights a lot of the issues that people who feel like they've fallen through the cracks when, you know, coming to Britain and haven't been given the support of that they need from the state. To what degree do you think that a lot of issues that people face who are in need, who have come via immigration or who are seeking asylum in Britain face, is related to certain prejudices that are a unfortunate part of society and mean that they're not helped perhaps in the way that they should be, and that more needs to be done to ensure that the system isn't so politicized and that more focus is placed on helping the individuals who are most in need rather than using them as a political ball, as is sometimes used by some politicians.
I mean, it's always the case that migration is a fraught political issue under both parties, and over many decades since mass travel became an issue, it's always been prone to being exploited. But I think that the kind of accretion of restrictions, what's known as NERF, or no recourse to public funds, which means there's an attachment to your visa when you arrive in the UK that says that, like, you're not allowed to use welfare services if you need them in terms of housing or benefits or whatever. And you know, you can see how that's going to, like, play well in the tabloids. You can also see that even without anyone being manipulated, a lot of voters in the UK will think, well, you know, we've paid in for this and people shouldn't be able to come from other countries and use these services. But it is now, like, the slow accretion of these kind of restrictions. These are people who not only do we not allow to take no benefits, we frequently bar from working as well. So we kind of deliberately destitute them because we say you're not allowed proper benefits. You might or might not be entitled to some kind of very, very minimal benefits that are much less than even the very low rates everyone else gets. And we're not going to let you work. So you're in a bind. So now when we look at not just people below the statistical poverty lines, but the people who are turning up at homelessness centres, at kind of soup kitchens and all the rest of it, there's a Heriot Watt University, funded by JRF, does a kind of tally based on that kind of approach, and it's found, you know, rising overall destitution, and particularly within that, rapid rise in the no recourse to public fund migrant group. So it is when people see people sleeping on the street or sleeping in tents. There's a chap who's fallen between the gaps in the post Brexit rules. In Daniel Trilling's chapter, he's ended up sleeping in a tent near Thetford because, you know, he's not quite got the right to work anymore, even though he would do if he got the paperwork in time. But when we see this kind of really acute poverty, it often is to do with these restrictions that we've cumulatively, in a crowd-pleasing way, aimed at immigrants over the years. And although I say, you know, that, like, a lot of voters might feel like, well, you know, the welfare state should be there for the families and the people who paid into it, I don't think that people really want, really understand the logic of what they're voting for is with all these crackdowns on the rights of migrants. So, you know, if we take this woman, Mary, who is someone who everyone would think of as a deserving person. She ran away from Zimbabwe. We know about the horrors there because of the political violence. She feared being killed. She ran away in a terrible hurry because, of course, that's what you do if you're threatened with kind of political thugs like driving you out of your home. So she didn't have all the right paperwork on arrival. She has been in the UK 20 years. She's not a drug addict. She's someone who goes to church, but she's got no income and no right to work. You know, what does this mean? What this means is that this woman who we've had as living amongst us in the UK for 20 years, when she wants to go to sleep, has to go and sit in St. James's Hospital foyer because that's a warm place that you can go at night until someone kicks her out. Or she has to go down the street to where the mega bus goes to London and then drives back to Leeds, you know, the cut price bus you'll have seen on the M1 that says £1 return ticket, and someone will have discarded or will give her a ticket and she can get on the mega bus and sit on it, go down to Victoria Coach Station, then come back to Leeds, and that gets you 8 hours of sleep. But that's the only way she can sleep if she doesn't want to sleep on a park bench. And like I say, I mean, she's not done anything that anyone would really think of as undeserving. She's not fallen into drugs or whatever. She's just run away from political violence, and that's where she finds herself. And I mean, really, this is one of those things where we need politicians. It won't be easy at the moment when you look at the kind of nasty tactics they're using on both sides of the Commons at the moment. But to sort of make an appeal to people and say, you know, we like to think of ourselves as a civilized country. If we've got a 50-year-old woman who's been here for 20 years and done nothing wrong, and we're making her get on an overnight coach to from Leeds to London and back just to get 8 hours sleep, what kind of pass have we reached?
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, Tom. We're coming towards the end of the podcast. Thanks again for taking the time to speak to me. But I do have one final question for you. If you wanted anyone who reads this book to take one thing away from reading it, what one thing would you most like everybody who has read this book and will read this book to take away from the book?
It's always hard because there's a few, you know, there's the point I just made about Mary, there's specific holes in the benefit system that have been cut in terms of, you know, larger families. But I think the overarching message is that over a very long time, we've allowed the basic rates of these benefits to just get too low. So, you know, the carer's allowance that Mike gets in High Wycombe, £69 a week. I mean, he's bound to be on the edge or over the edge when he's being asked to live on £69 a week. Unemployment benefits, for example, for single adults have been frozen in real terms at best since the 1970s, where wages have gone up and up. So they've been tanking as a percentage of earnings for decades. And then in the last 10 years, I think it's true to say that in 8 years, we've suspended the ordinary uprating regime so that benefits have gone up by less than price inflation, which means that they've been going down. You know, inflation, like one of the really infuriating things about it is it obscures what's going on. In 8 out of the 10 last years, we've asked people whose benefits we'd actually frozen, the real value is benefits we'd already frozen for, you know, kind of 30 plus years. We've asked them to get poorer and poorer in 8 of the 10 last years. And I think really, until we've got a decent sort of basic rate of benefit, basic rate of income support, that means that when you have a change of circumstances, you lose a job, or you know, you're booted out of one house, so you have to go somewhere else, that isn't a trapdoor into poverty or even destitution, then everyone's going to be so scared and in such a panic all the time. It's not reasonable to ask them to take charge of their lives and to change other things. So that would be the message, is that the basic rate of safety net is too low. It's got low gradually. I understand public money is tight, but I think we can ratchet it back up gradually as well if we decide that's what we want to do.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Tom. If people want to find out more about you, more about the work of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and where they can get the book, where should they go to find these things?
Well, you can obviously just Google Joseph Rowntree Foundation to see its work, which is ongoing on its website. The book is available. It's out with Bite Back. All royalties, I should say, go to Leeds Asylum Support Network. So I feel conscience-free in saying if you want to buy it, you know, you can buy it in Amazon, you can buy it in Waterstones, you can buy it directly from the publisher Bite Back. It is a hardback, but it's as cheap as hardbacks get at $14.99. So if you're interested in this stuff, please do give it a read.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.